This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. For more than 100 years, the survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre have been fighting for justice, only to have a judge deliver a powerful blow to their efforts. What happens now?
We want the Supreme Court to overrule our judge, kick us back down to court, let us move forward discovery, and have the opportunity to prove our case. That's all we're asking for.
Can Tulsa Massacre survivors still find justice? Coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to A Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. The destruction of the Greenwood community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back in 1921, was largely forgotten over the course of American history, certainly by white America. The prosperous black community was burned to the ground, subjected to aerial bombing, the first in American history on a domestic soil, and hundreds of residents were killed and buried in mass graves. But the survivors and descendants of the victims have never stopped fighting for justice. Here's a clip of survivor Viola Fletcher testifying before Congress in 2021, 100 years after the massacre.
Still, Greenwood should have given me the chance to make truly make it in this country. Within a few hours, all of that was gone. The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and five siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seeing being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not. And other survivors do not. And our descendants do not.
Now the uphill climb for justice has encountered another obstacle. A long-shot lawsuit seeking reparations for the victims was dealt a blow in court. But the fight isn't over. Attorney DeMario Solomon Simmons is leading the charge, and he joins us now. DeMario Solomon Simmons, welcome back to A Word.
Jason, it's always good to talk to you, my brother.
Before we talk more about the case, let's talk a little bit about the history. So you joined us last year right after the mass shooting in Buffalo to talk about the Tulsa Massacre. And for those who didn't hear that or who aren't familiar with the history, give us just a brief portrait of the Greenwood community that was targeted in Tulsa.
Absolutely. The Greenwood community was the richest, most organized African-American community in the history of this country. We had 40 blocks of doctors, pharmacists, lawyers, seamstress, hotel owners, anything you can think of that's the so-called American dream, that was happening in Greenwood. It was land ownership, it was wealth, people owned planes, and it was a community. Sometimes we talk about Greenwood, we say Black Wall Street, but Black Wall Street was just a part of the greater Greenwood community. It was the city for all the black towns that surrounded it, because Oklahoma, as you know, Jason, was a black haven. And why was that? Because of the black Native Americans that were already here during Indian Territory that created the environment that had black people coming from all over the United States looking for a place to be free, independent, and prosperous.
For those who didn't watch Watchmen on HBO or didn't watch Lovecraft Country or haven't paid attention the last 2 or 3 years, what happened on May 31st of 1921?
On May 31st, well, on May 30th, there was a black young man by the name of Dick Rowland who was accused of assaulting a white woman. And we know that's a virtual death sentence at that time, if not even now. And they took him to the Tulsa County Jail, and a mob of up to 2,000 bloodthirsty whites came down calling for the death of Dick Rowland. And the major newspaper ran an article that said, "To lynch a Negro tonight." And these black men of Greenwood, the most prosperous, wealthiest, educated black men in the nation, millionaires, several of them was multimillionaires. They loved their community so much, and they loved Dick Rowland so much. These are people that were prominent, store owners, business owners, millionaires. They went across the tracks in their best clothes with their rifles and their guns and said to the sheriff, "Let us protect Dick Rowland because he's one of ours. Even though he may be a shoeshine boy to you, he's one of ours and we love him and we're going to protect him." The sheriff said, "No, we got it, boys. Y'all should go on home." They said, "We're not going anywhere." And then that mob, one of those racists that wanted to lynch Dick Rowland, said to OB Man, "What do you want to do with that gun?" And OB Man said, "I'll use it if I need to." OB Man was a World War I veteran. And that white man said, "Give me that gun." And he tried to snatch the gun from OB Man. The gun went off and all hell broke loose. Those 2,000 whites were deputized by the city and the county of Tulsa. The black man retreated back into Greenwood and they held off that mob for about 12 hours. And then unfortunately, the National Guard was brought in, and the National Guard had something called machine guns. And they set those machine guns up and they were able to cut and destroy all of the defenses of the black men, as who they were dying heroically as their women and children were escaping to the north and getting on the trains. And finally, they broke through, and literally a mob of up to 25,000 whites poured into Greenwood, burning everything in sight. But before burning, before murdering, before doing all of that, they looted the valuables of the Greenwood community. Then they burnt it to the ground. It was the first place, Jason, in the history of this country that was bombed from the air. It is the largest crime scene in the history of this country, where you have 40 blocks burnt to the ground, over 3,000 people disappeared, 8,000 people known to be homeless for up to 9 months, and a community that lost over $200 million in property damage alone.
We heard briefly at the beginning of this conversation from Viola Fletcher. And I mean, it's always amazing to hear her voice. I've had a chance to chat with her, with you. I've seen you on the air on MSNBC. Who are the other survivors that you're representing? And, you know, what are some of their most vivid memories of this terrorist attack?
Yeah, so we have three wonderful, unbelievable, special three living survivors. And you've already talked about Mother Viola Ford Fletcher, 109 years old. We have 108-year-old Leslie Benefield Randall, who we call Mother Randall. And then we have Mother Fletcher's younger brother, Hughes Van Ellis. We call him Uncle Red. He's 102 plus. Uncle Red was a baby at the time, so he doesn't have specific memories of the actual massacre. But both Mother Fletcher and Mother Randall can tell you about hearing the shots, smelling the smoke, seeing the bodies in the street, feeling the heat of the flames as they flared down the street, getting to safety, getting rounded up. Mother Randall was actually rounded up and taken to what they called at the time — this is not my words, this is the words of the time — concentration camps for the Negroes. Mother Fletcher remembers escaping in a covered wagon. Jason, think about this. We're talking about a time where a person is escaping a massacre in a covered wagon, where her mother put her behind in the wagon and put a something over her head and said, "Baby, don't look out." But she was so curious to see what was going on, and she moved that blanket and she looked out and she saw the plane. She heard the screams. She saw dead bodies. She saw the fire, smelt the smoke, and they made it to safety just east of Tulsa into a place called Claremore, where they lived in abject property. They left a house to live in a tent in the forest for 2 years. This is what my clients experienced. This is what the community of Greenwood experienced. And this is what this case is about.
We talk a lot about erased history in America, how violence perpetuated against black people, in particular by white folks, and particularly supported by the state, is erased. And that's not just in national conversation. That's not just because a bunch of people in Congress talking about CRT. But this is personal to you. You know, talk a little bit about the fact that you didn't even learn about much of this history and you grew up in the Greenwood area.
Jason, as you know, I went to middle school on Greenwood Avenue at Carver Middle School. Never recall hearing about this, went to the crown jewel of Greenwood, Booker T. Washington High School. Never recall hearing about this. I learned, as you stated, about this in class in 1997, my junior year at the University of Oklahoma, sitting in intro to African American Studies class with Dr. Kepler Newbrow-Kim, big, tall, 6'5", 335-pound man with a booming voice and long locks down his back. He intimidated me. I didn't want to say much in class, but when he started talking about this place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where these rich black folks had land and property and businesses and with millionaires, and I was sitting there and I raised my hand and said, hey, I'm from Tulsa. That's not true. I'm from Tulsa. I ain't never heard that, and I've never been more embarrassed in my life when I found out that I was the one that didn't know my own history. And from that day forward, I have been committed and obsessed with telling and teaching as many people and educating them about the massacre and advocating for justice and reparations for my people who suffered the massacre. My people, including my wife's grandmother, was a massacre a victim. My neighbor that across the street was a victim. I didn't even know it. So many people that I knew growing up, that I knew, whose houses I've been into, were victimized by the massacre, was destroyed, their businesses destroyed by the massacre, family members killed by the massacre, and I grew up not knowing about it. And that's why I'm passionate about making sure that everyone not only knows about it, but we'll do something about the continuing harm that we still are suffering.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more on the legal fight for Tulsa race massacre survivors. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. This is Jason Johnson, host of A Word, Slate's podcast about race and politics and everything else. I want to take a moment to welcome our new listeners. If you've discovered A Word and like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And let us know what you think by writing us at aword@slate.com. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about the Tulsa race massacre case with attorney DeMario Solomon Simmons. DeMario, tell us a little bit about who is this judge and what was her ruling in your case?
Our judge's name is Caroline Wall. She's an elected Oklahoma State District Judge. According to her own website, she's a quote-unquote constitutional conservative. What she did in May of 2022, she actually stated from the bench and ruled that our case would be able to move forward to discovery, meaning she had overruled or denied the motion to dismiss by the city and other perpetrators. And then she actually, 3 months later, kind of changed up her ruling somewhat in a written order in August of 2022, but we thought we were still moving forward based upon what was stated to us. And then on May 10th, 2023, which happened to be Mother Fletcher's 109th birthday, we had another hearing where she stated she was going to make a ruling within 7 days. It took over 2 months for a ruling to occur, and we found out Friday night at 7:45. I found out Friday night at 7:45 on July 7th from a reporter sending me a text message saying, how do you care to comment about the dismissal of your case? Jason, I was shocked. I felt like I had been hit with a sledgehammer, 500-pound sledgehammer in my stomach, because one, I couldn't believe we had lost. because the law and the facts are so clearly on our side. Two, I couldn't believe it was done the way it was done in a Friday night, and I learned about it from a reporter. And three, all I could think about after I got over my own hurt and depression and literal tears is I got to call my clients on a Friday night and explain to them that their case has been dismissed and I have no reason why, because the judge didn't give us any reason at that time.
Even though this happened 100 years ago, you are standing on the shoulders of other people who have fought for this case. There's some folks out there who think, oh yeah, I haven't heard about this. This must be relatively new. But there had been legal efforts and court efforts and local government efforts and banking efforts before you. What were some of the attempts to get reparations, to get justice for Tulsa survivors before you got involved?
Man, absolutely. I stand tall on the shoulders of people like B.C. Franklin, attorney B.C. Franklin, the father of Dr. John Hope Franklin, the great historian, and attorneys I.W.H. Spears, attorney, so many other attorneys that started filing lawsuits and fighting for justice and reparations literally days after the massacre. There's a very famous picture of B.C. Franklin and his law partner, I.W. Spears, in a tent with law books, literally days after the massacre. I had that picture recently blown up after this dismissal because it gives me inspiration to know that as much opposition, obstacles, and odds that we face today, these brothers were literally practicing law on the ashes of their law building in a tent, filing lawsuits against the very people that had just burnt down and murdered their entire community. That is the legacy that whose shoulders I stand on. I stand on the shoulders of Professor Charles Ogletree, one of my personal mentors, who in the early 2000s brought a civil rights case along with the late, great Johnny Cochran, and people like Professor, my good friend, Professor Eric Miller, people like attorney Michelle Roberts, who many know her as the just retired NBA Players Association president, but she's an unbelievable litigator. People like Audra Artur and so many more who have in this fight, so many non-lawyers who've been pushing this issue, pushing City Hall, pushing state government, people like State Representative Don Ross and State Senator Maxine Horner, who did the initial Tulsa Race Riot Commission report at the late 90s, early 2000s. I stand on the shoulders of all these people, and that's why I know that victory will be ours, because in 1921, there's a postcard, Jason, that specifically says, there's a postcard of the massacre. You know how these people, these sadistic people, like to make postcards and cut off souvenirs of our suffering. One of these postcards, and it said on there, run the Negro out of Tulsa. That was the stated objective of the massacre. We still here 102 years later. We're still fighting 102 years later. And we're still believing in truth, justice, and reparations 102 years later.
For a long time, Tulsa was referred to as a race riot. And that terminology can have sort of a direct impact on people, right? Because race riot is kind of a neutral term, right? Oh, okay, it's a riot between races. It doesn't elicit fault, right? It doesn't show the direction of causality. Talk a little bit about that. Talk a bit about how important it is to refer to it as the Tulsa Massacre, as opposed to race riot, which is what it was referred to for the last 60, 70 years.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the fact that I was one of the first people to make that a very specific issue and ask. I remember in law school when I wrote my thesis on the Tulsa Race Massacre, and I argued at that time, because everybody still was calling it the riot, just what you just stated, that a riot conjures up the wrong mental picture that these two groups must spontaneously, oh, who's responsible? No, this was a massacre, it was a pogrom. Some people even call it a Holocaust, because the Holocaust literally means destruction by fire, and this was a community that was destroyed by fire. So I was a big proponent of that, and was very happy that the RCC, which was the Reparations Coordinating Committee, which was headed by Professor Charles Ogletree and Audra Artur, who were doing the litigation in the early 2000s, I was a clerk for that, and they adopted that language, and we really pushed that and made sure that people stopped saying race riot. And right now, when someone says the Tulsa race riot, I think you may have a slip of the tongue, but really that shows a level of consciousness at this point, because this was truly a massacre. And that's the thing about the Tulsa Race Massacre. It's not unique that black communities were destroyed across this country. That happened every year all over the United States of America. It's too many even to name. But the thing about the Tulsa Race Massacre that is unique and why it's so important to our overall history and our quest for racial justice is this fact. It was the largest. It was the scope and scale of it. We're talking about 40 blocks. We're talking about 10,000 to 12,000 people. We're talking about $200 million of property damage. damage. And we're talking about black people, literally a generation and a half out of enslavement, that had done everything that America says we have to do. Own land, work hard, have a business, mind our own business. We did all of that. We built it all up, and you came and they bombed it out, because that is actually the American way, not this whole mythical we believe in liberty and justice for all. The American way is to exploit black people, destroy black people, take black people's land and property. But that's what we're fighting to really change that and make sure that that doesn't happen for further generations.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more about the fight for justice for the victims of the Tulsa Race Massacre with attorney Demario Solomon Simmons. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about the legal battle for the survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre with attorney Demario Solomon Simmons. So how did the three surviving victims respond to this legal setback? And I mean, they've lived double our lives, right? Me and you combined our lives, they have lived longer. So I'm sure they've got a perspective that we can't fathom at this point. But what was their response to the judge's ruling?
They were shocked. They were disappointed. They didn't understand why, especially when I told them, well, we didn't have a written order, so we didn't know what the rationale was. I will say this too. You're right. They've lived through dust bowls and two world wars and two pandemics and real deal Jim Crow. So they're very resilient. And they simply said, hey, well, what's the next step? You know, what else can we do? And that really picked me up, because Jason, I was devastated. I was devastated. I mean, that night I couldn't sleep. My hip was hurting. I didn't get any rest. I got up really early Saturday morning. I was trying to just do something to get my mind off of it. And my wife said, you need to lay back down. You're not looking good. And it took me about 36 hours to get over that. And I want to talk about that, because I think, you know, we have to acknowledge how difficult this work is. And we have to acknowledge, you know, I am a warrior, right? This is law of my ministry, justice is my passion. I'm built for this life, but I am a human. And I have to acknowledge that. And we have to acknowledge that, those of us that's in this space fighting for racial justice and equity and all those things, because we have to suspend the reality. You know, and I had this conversation with my interim chief of staff. I was like, man, am I crazy to really believe? I'm psychotic. I'm crazy to believe that a system that for 102 years, this is what it has done. This is it. This is not new, but I suspend my reality, because only with suspension of reality and belief 100% that I can be successful, am I able and willing to do the double, triple the amount of work that I have to do than my opponents, just to have an opportunity. And that's why I hurt so bad, because you start thinking about, man, look at all I am putting into this. And all the people that are on our side putting into this for this system to do what it just always does. No, I don't have to even give you a reason. I just have more power than you. So it took about 36 hours to get over that. And talking to the survivors helped me do that, because they are wisdom personified. That's when we start thinking about our appeal. We do have an appeal process. And again, here I am. I'm suspending reality again. Hey, I fully believe we're going to be successful in our appeal. Had a powerful meeting today with a new member of our team, appellate member of our team. I think it's going to be a fantastic addition. I think we have an opportunity to reverse this clearly erroneous, unjust decision in our belief. We do have a conservative Supreme Court. So that's what we're up against. And that's why I appreciate brothers like you who did check on me, and so many other people around the nation, giving me this platform and helping us get people to come to justiceforgreenwood.org. justiceforgreenwood.org, connect with us, donate to this work. This work is taxing emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually, but also financially. Sign up for our newsletter, make phone calls. One of the things that we're doing, Jason, and you know this, is trying to get our dear sister, and I say that with all sincerity, our dear sister, Kristen Clark, Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, to come in and open the very first ever criminal investigation of the massacre. And they have the power to do that pursuant to the Emmett Till Act of 2007, Emmett Till Act's Cold Case Act of 2007, reauthorized in 2016. We've had four meetings with the Department of Justice. The last meeting was in May of 2023. And we're telling them that this dismissal is further proof that Oklahoma will not do right. So if anybody wants to help out, go to Justice for Greenwood, make a donation, sign up for our newsletter, and send our dear sister Christian Clark an email and say, investigate Tulsa.
And that's great, because I was going to ask you, you know, what people can do. So that's a perfect answer, what people can do can support you. But here's the thing. I always, you know, I always want to end the podcast, if not on a positive note, at least on a where do we go from here or what do we do next? So with the judge dismissing the case with prejudice, just, you know, before we finish with our audience, what is your next step? What does prejudice mean? And what are your steps for appeal now in order to get justice for the victims of Greenwood?
With prejudice simply means we cannot refile the case again. So our next steps is to appeal. We have our appeal. Our appeal is due by August 6th. We will hit that deadline without a doubt, without any problems. And we're going to appeal, and we're going to ask. I don't want to get too down in the weeds, but in Oklahoma, when you appeal, the Supreme Court can decide to then kick it down to the Civil Court of Appeals. Obviously, we're asking that the Supreme Court retain jurisdiction of this issue. We're going to put front and center that our clients are all above 102 years old, that this is time is of the essence, and we want the Supreme Court to overrule our judge, kick us back down to court, let us move forward discovery, and have the opportunity to prove our case. That's all we're asking for. The judge kicked us out without giving us the opportunity to prove our case, and that's what we're trying to do. That's what we plan to do. And with the help of people like you and your listeners and our great legal team, I think we'll be successful in getting it done.
Demario Solomon Simmons is an attorney, and he is representing the survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Thank you so much for joining us today on A Word, and you know I'm going to keep in touch with you.
No problem, bro. Appreciate you. Peace.
And that's A Word for this week. The show's email is aword@slate.com. This episode was produced by Christy Taiwo Macanjula. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the Vice President of Slate Audio. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for A Word.